You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Kulapat Yantrasat. Kulapat, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Let's talk about what you're working on now. I want to discuss galleries and museums, but perhaps you can talk about a current project you're working on and how that's coming along.
Well, we have a lot of things happening here, both into the art and, you know, lifestyle section. You know, our museum in Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky, the Speedart Museum, is finally finishing. We're going to open next year in March, and so this is really the last curve that is really getting everything in place. So that's quite exciting for me. At the same time, we also have been working for a private museum in Los Angeles for the Marciano Foundation, which is an old Masonic temple that is being converted into a contemporary art museum. So that's also equally exciting on this coast.
And let's talk about, you know, perhaps the first one. When you approach the building of a whole museum, how do you approach that? It seems such a tall task and so difficult. And I imagine now museums want everything exhibited and so much wall space. But what is your approach when creating a museum, if I can say something, ask a question that general?
Yes, well, you know, I always, when I design museums or gallery spaces and things like that, I always feel that, you know, I have the role of a matchmaker between art and people. So, you know, I think I'm trying to, just like introducing good friends together, that I would like them to be themselves. You know, there's no need to be manipulate and allow them to really have a good encounter between the two of them. And so when it comes to museums, that, you know, art have power to communicate. Therefore, you know, if you really are generous about creating a wonderful environment, lighting, proportions, and things like that, it really allows the power of the art to connect with people. And that's what we do a lot. And in the case of the Speedart Museum itself, I think it's quite unique because it's been expanding since 1927 when it first built. Many generations have built many expansions and changes along the way. So in this case, you know, I think think of this as almost like a living object, almost like a, you know, I would call something like a grandmother that continued to live, you know, many generations. She lived beyond you, before you, and you continue to live, you know, after you're gone. So therefore, your job is not just to do something for today, but really help this living organization to move on to next generation, help to improve the health of the building, help it to communicate better to, you know, our generation. At the same time, make it also have chances to survive and thrive in the future. So for this Speedart Museum in general, you know, we have kind of call our mode of intervention acupuncture architecture. And what it means is that, you know, it really focusing on the belief that, you know, there's such a museum or such a building has a life that is, you know, something that you help to improve by the act of strategic interventions in areas around the building. Therefore, you're not just adding, you're not doing plastic surgery, you're not adding something that's not necessary, but you kind of intervene to the point that it actually helps what already exists thrive and, you know, be better. So that's kind of what we hope to achieve in our work.
And you're talking about the, you know, just now the whole landscape around it, which, yeah, perhaps sometimes is dismissed somewhat, or we make so much of the actual building itself, but you're talking also about, by interventions, the dialogue between the landscape and the building. Is that what you mean?
Yes, absolutely. You're right. Thank you. Thank you for bringing it up, because that's a big part of it, in the sense that if you're only looking at the problem from one side, you'll never really be able to solve all of it. And in this particular case, you know, this is absolutely true, because when the building was built in 1927, you know, it was built as a temple for art. It's an isolated, you know, kind of a classical building with no windows, that clad with the limestone and built with the best materials available at that time. Throughout the time, it's become almost like a mausoleum. It becomes something that really do not communicate to the urban life around it, do not communicate to the students. The Speedart Museum sit on the campus of University of Louisville, which have around 10,000 students passing by every day, no one getting, because everyone thinks it's, you know, something that doesn't belong to them, or, you know, they don't have any involvement with. So the thinking, not only just inside the building, but around the building in terms of landscape, and really make the whole indoor-outdoor, make the museum be part of the city and part of the campus, is really part of the acupuncture plan that we have.
I love that way of thinking about it. It sounds, you know, as though it's a living thing. And when you mentioned especially the word mausoleum, I remember a curator once saying that to me when it was about a museum in Spain, and I think he was talking more about the content, but I was proposing a show, and I remember he said to me, Brainerd, this is not a museum the way you think. It's a mausoleum. And, you know, he really meant, you know, we're not going to do kind of progressive projects here. But to use your word and that word, how does something not become a mausoleum? Because museums are so set up, you know, even the most beautiful ones to be this kind of permanent structure. How do we prevent them from becoming what you mean by a mausoleum? How is that prevented?
Well, I think, you know, then you have to start asking why, you know, people built the museum the way they built, which, you know, when they built it, they didn't plan this to be a mausoleum, but it turned into a mausoleum for different generations after that, because it's just, you know, very intimidating, basically mostly stone-cladded solid box, right? And then because, of course, they want the maximum wall spaces, because they want the flexibility, they want as many walls they can hang art on, so that's one thing. And the second is, so they build these buildings as symbols of culture, the symbol of authority and cultures and education and the highest achievement that mankind can make in that generation. So all of that combined, creating this sense of intimidating, not about you, it's all about us kind of mentality, which I think modern museums now, and perhaps even more in the future, are finding themselves really have to rewrite. Because, you know, I mean, art, if art exists without people engaging with it, whether it actually does give a lot of inspiration to people, maybe not. And big museums would used to be just, you know, a storage hall for painting for people to go and look at, are now turning itself into a cultural hub of every sense of the word. It's not just about passively looking at art. It's about engaging in art making. It's about meeting with your communities in the museum, in an environment that allows you to contemplate, you know, higher goal in life, as well as it's a mundane social aspect, as, you know, dining and entertaining and shopping. So all of these combine to what a museum fits, and a lot of people, if you talk to them, they actually want museum to be part of that, you know, anything from movies. And so because of that, I think we need to really look at what museum should be built for this generation, you know, without compromising the art. I think some of the things that, for example, if I may add, one of the first buildings that I worked on, which is with Tadawando when I was still in Japan, was the Fort Worth Art Museum. And I was a project architect on that project. And, you know, I think it was an interesting solution that, you know, many people could also learn from, is that we provide maximum wall space by creating these boxes, which is, in that case, repetition. And then we clad this building with glass walls so that you have the mass, you have the wall spaces you need, but at the same time you have this transitional kind of ambulatory space between the gallery and the garden or the landscape, so allow people to be walk around. And by giving that, you know, have the cake and eat it too kind of thinking, you have, you're not diluting the art experience, because that most people like that to be the case, but you also implement it with space that people can be themselves. You know, they can take break from looking at arts and then looking at water and trees. They can also take breaks to go and, you know, have a cup of coffee and go back to the gallery. So that, in a way, is dealing with you know, this kind of monolithic art space by allowing you to have something else.
I like that because also that's the idea of taking breaks too and looking outside seems so important to the, especially the museum experience. I mean, when I go to the Metropolitan Museum, you know, it's exhausting walking through there. Even if I, when I try to get to the Contemporary Collection, I have to almost put on blinders, cover my eyes because it's, there's so much there and it's so overwhelming really and exhausting. So that seems like a wonderful approach. You, since that was the, you know, a project with Taro Ando, and you're talking about, you know, your system of belief with your firm in this kind of interventions and interactions. Is that something that, that came from your work with Taro Ando? And if so, how do you depart from that? Are you essentially, what I'm asking, a kind of protege of his that, that's continuing a kind of similar philosophy or belief, or are you... are you separating from that with your own beliefs that you began articulating at the beginning of this?
Well, I think I learned a lot from that, absolutely. And I think, you know, I worked there for almost 8 years, so I also kind of contributed a lot to that practice as well, but they're very different because, you know, I think the sense of space, you know, the sense of what, you know, architecture means, the different generations, the way that, you know, art and architecture and life and things in general are defined, I think, it's interesting because when I was at one of the first buildings that we built is a museum in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is, I mean, we got a lot of recognition out of that project. It's the first green new art museum in the world that got the LEED Gold. So, and it's a ground-up building right in the middle of Grand Rapids, and it really changed the way downtown is. It's really a project that I'm very proud of. And, you know, I think we have reached out to Ellsworth Kelly, who's a wonderful artist that I have known before, and I think it's important to have Ellsworth work in the lobby. And Ellsworth has come out to look at the building and then through the installations and many things. And because he's someone that, I, that know me from way before when it was, you know, I mean, a baby architect. So, you know, and for that project, you know, I chose to use concrete because that's material that it's very green. You can get the ingredients from local sources, so you don't have to do a lot of transport. And it's a material that I know how to do without, you know, using a lot of money. It's very cost efficient when you do it right. So I use concrete. But in the back of my mind, I feel like, well, would people think that this is going to be too close to the underworld because he's known for his concrete work? So
right.
Over dinner, I asked Elsa Kelly, well, what do you think? Would people see this as like an underwork? And Elsa was really, you know, really said, no, not at all. Because, you know, he's Japanese and you're Thai. You know, his way of controlling space and control people are very Japanese. It's a very, it's a sense of order and it's a very sense of discipline. In your building, even though you use similar materials, it's a very generous experience. You allow people to look one way and the other. People can walk around. I mean, the circulation is not controlled in a way that, let's say, a Japanese garden or something that you see in the underwork is. So it was, and it was something as casual as that over dinner that I kind of understood. Of, wow, I mean, that's really true, and it's something that I would not be able to. To do, I mean, I don't see architecture as a way of controlling people's behavior. I'm seeing architecture as a way to kind of encourage them to do something different. But I learned a lot from the philosophy and the methods of how architecture can have power on people's experience. So that for sure. But I think the message that I put in the work is quite different.
And that makes sense, and it's clear. And I wanted to talk about the Grand Rapids Museum, Art Museum, because there was, you know, such an enormous amount of attention for that, and why do you think that was such a success for you? I mean, that's a beautiful way that Ellsworth Kelly kind of articulated the difference between, you know, Taro Ando and you and that building. Why do you think it also received that LEED certification? What was, in your mind, or what was perceived as exceptional about that building?
Well, I think, you know, the project started before me, and a lot of credits were have to be given to the civic leaders of Grand Rapids because, you know, they were, they planned the building to be there right in the center of the city. It's a full block, right, you know, and in front of it, they have commissioned Maya Lin to do amazing, wonderful public space, land art that could really be used for multi-purpose. And so that alone is already, you know, kind of part of that. And the timing was perfect because that's happened when people have started to really wanted to move back to downtown, just like any other American cities that have, you know, kind of the wipe out downtown mentality. So, you know, but then when I got involved with that project, I know that this is a museum that is not, it cannot be a closed museum. You know, no matter what you want the art experience to be, this function as the living room for the city, it has to serve as many, many, many things for the city. It's not just, you know, the picture gallery that people go to look at paintings. So we designed it in a way that it's mostly, really, it's as porous as it could be. You know, I think, again, I mean, around 78% of the spaces have natural light, from galleries to offices, and the porosity of the building in the front that really let the Mayan Lin Park really penetrate into the building, you know, having more interactive spaces. And again, I mean, the green aspect of the building is something that did not start with me. I mean, the civic leaders, especially in this case, the late Peter Wege, who is a visionary in terms of environmental design, he's the one that said, this building has to be the most green possible because museums in general consume a lot of energy. We need to be a leader in thinking that we can really care for the art without having to spend all this money and energy cooling and heating it. So that was a mission that I took in, and then I tried to design it so that we can achieve, you know, the efficiency of the building without turning the building into a refrigerator.
I love that, and that, I imagine, you know, helped you enormous amount in your firm grow, because that got so much attention. And it was, you know, several years later that I think it was Art and Auction magazine thought of you as one of the most powerful people in the art world, or one of the 100 most powerful people. Was that also because of, you think, that museum design, or was it because of your gallery design work? You seem to have such a close relationship with art, and I'm wondering if there's something I'm missing. Is it also your gallery work that you think was so appreciated by the art world?
Yes, I guess so. I think the museum work, you know, we have a few finished and in the work, but I think a lot more people also know us through the gallery work. So we've done mostly in Los Angeles. And I think, and, you know, the other thing, too, is because, you know, I really, you know, I'm sure most architects are, too, but I really enjoy looking at art. I enjoy having conversation with people like you and artists. I like to, you know, I like that unknown aspect, especially looking at architecture from art perspective, because I think that allow me to see my possibility better. And because of that, I think more and more people in the art community actually know me through the work. And I've done a few galleries, you know, starting from L&M in Venice, which it's a very simple project, but really loved by the art community here in Los Angeles. And then we did another Perry Rubenstein in Hollywood, and we just completed David Kodansky Gallery, which last year, which really also received an amazing love and interest from not only art collectors but artists themselves. And I'm so, you know, proud with it, because, you know, something as simple as that, because, you know, some of these galleries, you know, exist already in some kind of industrial building, so you have limited capacity to turn it into spaces that can be conducive to show art in. And this is the case, and I think artists are so sensitive that they know what they're trying to do with the little kind of, you know, capacity that you're given. So that, from that, and I think that I, because of that, and one of the things that I'm not sure you know, that we've done a lot in our offices in Los Angeles and also New York, is that we host salon talk within our own offices almost monthly, and the subjects are changing from art, fashion, branding, architecture, gardening, you know, ceramics, and sometimes even something mundane as, you know, like kind of like checklists and things like that. So, and this gives us the opportunity for our architects staff to not only, you know, exchange ideas with people that we are interested in. I think we actually take time, we cook, take a day, maybe half a day off to cook the meal for everyone that come in. So it's not a lecture itself. But because of that, it allowed us to also connect better to our cultural communities that we're interested in. And the salon, I think we started around 6 years ago in Los Angeles. And when I moved here, because of how the city is so far apart, and I find myself going to all these events, cocktails and dinners and things like that, and I feel like, wow, they're all the same. I never have a really good conversation coming out of these meetings, of these parties at all. And so I realized that in order to have a good conversation, you have to host it yourself. And because of that, then I started to seek out people that I want to talk to and then do a salon as a way of engaging our people, our staff, as well as our friends who can help to make that conversation more, even more interesting.
That's fascinating. And the people that you invite in, it sounds like they're from a variety of fields. Are they all also local people? Are those all from the Los Angeles area, the speakers, so to speak, that come in and give a presentation and begin a conversation?
Well, we try to mix it in. I think it depends, and I'm not the only one who think about these projects. Right? For example, sometimes we have local people. Normally, we try to bring someone that people don't know, but we feel like first of all, we're curious about what that person has to say, so that's important for us to invite someone in. And then we feel like, well, these are the things that, well, so who else should know about this? For example, in Los Angeles, we invite Scott Flags, who's a wonderful architectural colorist, to talk about what roles colors play in environment. And we invite, you know, our own people, we invite psychologists, we invite decorators, we invite artists. And this is so fascinating because, of course, Scott talked about the colors, but he talked about life and how colors mean to him in not just his work, and it was profoundly meaningful. And the food, we also try to cook something related to that. For example, if you do a session in New York with a fashion designer, we try to also get someone that can cook, you know what the speaker like to do, and then cook something that surprised them, you know, whether it is from their hometown or something that they interested in. So we take time to kind of make it into something a little bit meaningful. And I think the key to that is that we also invite a few provocateurs, in the sense someone that just ask nasty questions during things, because I think it breaks the ice. I think that was part of thing. And we always, because we have offices in New York and L.A., we try to host our speakers from New York and L.A., and vice versa, that we want to also invite our, you know, kind of get our LA friends to our New York friends. So that has been something we try to do.
I love that idea because there sounds like that's such fertile ground for everyone learning more. And I think I would like to talk a little bit more also in closing, really, in the last part of our interview, about gallery design, because it seems such a different approach, I would imagine, than a museum, which is kind of encyclopedic, and maybe a gallery won't be there forever. Is a gallery approached very differently than a museum, and if so, how?
Well, I think, you know, I relate galleries more to let's say residential, because the scales are different, right? I think a gallery has missions as well, and even gallery spaces, which might start as a showroom to sell art, is now, you know, developing into something more communal. You know, that's an aspect of gallery as a place is for artists that belong to the gallery to hang out. There's people that work there, there are people that are fans of the gallery. So I think even within the scope of the gallery design, it also getting richer and more interesting. But, I mean, I think of them quite different from the museums because, you know, I think, you know, gallery has a focus and it's a place that, for me, a gallery is more about the artist. And most of the time, the gallery we do are working with artists who are still living. You know, I got to be good friends with the artists that show in the gallery that I design, and that's one of my pride that, you know, I got to be friends with someone that actually liked the work I've done. And so that's really quite a big thing for me. And so by creating a gallery space, you have a dialogue with the gallery owner. You also have dialogues with the artists who will show there. For example, you know, when we were building the gallery for LM Arts in Venice, California, I think I was told by the workers, like, well, there's this weird kind of guy coming around and looking at the buildings, and we have a building which have a diamond shape plan, a very, very small building, like a little chapel. And then it turned out that this is you know, Thomas Hunsaker, who's the artist who will be showing in the gallery when it's done. But Thomas took the effort to actually look at the building when it's under construction and really understand what is coming up, and he was very fascinated by the shape of the building. And then after that, we become friends, and he was talking about how this plan. So that was a process in the gallery design for me, which in a way, you know, that's a dialogue that you have. But with the museum, you really feel like you're having the dialogues, a conversation with the city, with the communities. It's not just about the museum directors and the people that work at the museum, but it's really more about what does this building serve, what kind of communities. And when you work on museums like what we do, you end up talking about people that do not come to the museum today, like the minorities, the communities that were not, you know, part of the museum experience before, and how do you open the museum up to make these people feel that they're welcome. So that's more of the thinking in that.
Kulapad, it's been wonderful talking with you. In closing, is there anything else you want to say about a project that you'd like people to see, whether they're in New York or L.A., favorite projects of yours? I mean, we're talking to mostly artists in this, although I'm talking to more architects all the time, but there's a lot of people that are in the arts listening to this, and certainly there'll be links to many of your buildings in this interview, but is there a place in New York or L.A. that you would particularly like to encourage people to go to?
Well, a lot of the things that we do are actually private homes and things like that, so that might be a little bit more complicated to see. I mean, I think, you know, in a way, my house is a good example of the qualities and openness that we talked about, so I'd like people to see that, and I would be happy to show it to you or anyone that wants to see it. I think the galleries we do, I think the other building that might really be quite wonderful for people to see, which is it's the Art Studio Hall at Pomona College, which we just opened last October. And it is a very porous, simple building that really creates for people to work and make art together. And I think that I'm very proud of how it turned out. It's a very open process because we involve everyone, the students, the faculty, the parents, you know, the communities from the beginning of the project until the completion. And now to see how the students are actually hacking the building and using it the way they want to is amazing, because that's what I want that building to be. It's not a precious white space that people need to feel, you know, kind of nervous about. It's a place that allows people to, you know, it's like a sandbox. You can make mess in it, but at the same time, it still looks good. So that's a good example of what maybe people should see.
I love that. Thank you so much, Kulapad, for talking with me today.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Brennan.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.